So, good afternoon, everyone. Cheers. Let's toast Reese Bowen.
Let me grab a photo. There we go. I love it. All right, one more. Wait, back up the side. I missed you. All right, and one more. This is the sort of thing. There we go. Thank you.
One of the important duties of the bookstore, aside from hosting the author and buying the books, is to give feedback to the publisher, because publishers don't ever show up for book events, and the only way they know how successful Reese and Claire will be, and the whole thing today, is for me to send them both the links and the photos. So that's always really fun. I'm so delighted. How many of you are new? I should always start by asking that. Well, thank you very much for coming. I'm Barbara Peters, and I own the store. And Reese and I have been friends from almost the beginning. No, I'm too much older than Reese, so that isn't true. But really, since almost the beginning of your career. And certainly Claire and I have been together the entire time. But one of the reasons I love doing the Molly Murphys, and thank you for bringing them back, is my only chance to wear my fabulous bracelet from Kildare Abbey in Ireland that has the clovers and the whole bit. I remember to get it out every year so I can come down here and celebrate Ireland.
Well, this year it's not St. Patrick's Day, so I didn't have to wear green, but she's got her Irish scarf on.
It's actually on a Sunday. But anyway, March is kind of a wonderful month. It's Women's History Month, it's St. Patrick's Day, it's Ramadan, it's also Easter this year on March 31st. So it's a very busy month in which to celebrate things. But we're here today to talk about In Sunshine and in Shadow, which is this the 20th Molly Murphy?
It's the 20th Molly Murphy.
Wow.
Can you imagine?
No.
Yeah.
And we must thank Reese's daughter, Claire, for bringing Molly back, because Reese has been so busy writing many things. Molly kind of had to take a break, right?
Yeah.
So talk to us about it.
Yeah. Well, about 3 years ago now, Claire came to me and said, I think I would, because I'd had to put Molly on hiatus because I just didn't have time to write anymore. Claire said, I think I'd like to write the Molly Murphy series with you. And I thought, oh, okay. And I was a little ambivalent about this because she's my daughter and I love her. You know, I thought, what if this doesn't work out and I have to say, no, we really can't work together. But you know, she came in at day one having read the whole series with Molly's voice perfect, with loads of good ideas, and we just took off. I mean, literally, we started writing together and it was seamless, wasn't it? You know, she'd say, how about I write the next chapter at the party because I can envisage that, and I'd say, good, and then we'd read each other's, we'd polish each other's, and now you can't tell who wrote what. Yeah, I have to say too that here last year someone said to me, so how did you two hook up? and I said, I made her.
In case you think it's easy for someone to approach a well-respected author and announce that they want to write a series with them, it's true that Claire had the entree, but Reese has pointed out that the difficult side, if you're working with family, is that it could really disrupt things. You know, so it was a bit of a gamble on both your parts.
It was, yeah. But you know, the wonderful thing, apart from Claire and I write, we laugh, we talk every day, good excuse to talk every day, we laugh every day. She loves the research. And so please tell us what you do.
So I read the New York Times for every day that our book takes place. And every book that we do definitely has a very specific time in history. And I can get too detailed. I mean, if we want them to go on a picnic, I might say, well, it was raining that day, so they can't do that.
And I say, shut up.
So I love to know all of the color of what was going on in New York in 1908 for this book. And it's just so easy to go down that rabbit hole, discovering more and more. The wonderful thing is when you find the connections and you think, oh, wait, these people I've been researching connect to these people I've been researching. And suddenly a story starts to come out of that research.
So I remember when Reese first talked to me about Molly Murphy way back in the day, one of the things that you used to do was read advertisements in periodicals and newspapers of that time, because you can learn an amazing amount about products that are advertised. So do you do that too, Claire?
I do, and I pay attention to things like in the summer of 1908, wheat prices had gone up. So there's probably a sentence in the book that bread is really expensive. I mean, to us, you know, we wouldn't think that's a big deal, but if we think it's a big deal for us when recently the price of bread has doubled, that's something the average person would be aware of. So I think about it.
Yeah, you know, I have on a CD, I have the Sears catalog for 1901. And you can actually, you could buy a house on a Sears catalog. You could buy all sorts of interesting things. I also have menus for a lot of the restaurants in New York, so I know exactly. They had the strangest food, didn't they?
Really strange, yes.
And a lot of it, too. The courses were... Oh, I always chuckle when you say Sears catalog. I'm actually married to Julius Rosenwald's great-grandson, and Julius Rosenwald founded Sears and Roebuck.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Sears catalog was the Amazon of its day,
it was,
without which the West would have had much more difficulty becoming settled because Sears sold houses, they sold barbed wire fencing, they sold almost anything you can imagine.
Yeah.
You know, we forget about that. We think Amazon is some new and shiny toy, where you can buy things and get it delivered everywhere, but that's not true.
No, it was Sears. Yeah. Going back to the food, you might see food that you think you would know, but it's something completely different. I just stumbled across a book called What I Feed My Children. From the early 1900s. It was 1913, and I was excited to find it because I thought, perfect.
Yeah.
Now, you know, this great food, I saw that one of the snacks was brownies, but then there's a menu part at the back, and a brownie was take some toast, lightly butter it, cube it and put it in the oven, and then pop it out when it's brown. And those are brownies.
Yes, yeah, so if anybody from 1901 offers you a brownie, don't take it.
So that would be, actually, since you are taking Molly out of New York City and up into upstate New York and over to the Catskills, where there is a nascent Jewish community and also a kind of a free-spirited bohemian community, I suspect that the Jewish community probably was adhering to dietary laws. They probably were not quite as reformed as today, and therefore there would be some real challenges in keeping kosher in a place like that.
That would be that precisely. This comes out in the book that part of the family we talk about are keeping kosher, but there's no rabbi within 10-15 miles, and when somebody dies, you know, you're supposed to have the whole sitting shiva and everything, or you're supposed to bury the body within 24 hours. So all these things become really difficult up there. So I think, you know, part of the family is much more reformed and much more lenient, but they're not all, are they?
No, it is a huge tension. A part of the family is much more recent immigrants, and a part are very sort of urbane city dwellers just coming out for the summer.
Yeah.
Now, I have to tell you that coming today, I felt a little bit, when you have that dream that you're going to have a test the next day and you forgot to study for it. Because for this book, I did so much research that I could have written a master's thesis on the Catskills. Mm-hmm. But then since the book came out, we've written another book and turned it in, and I haven't done my homework. And every single scene had hours and hours of research. But then, of course, when you read the book, you won't say, oh, here's a master's thesis. You'll think, oh, Molly went somewhere and did something.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing, in case you didn't know, the reason that Jewish people started going up to the Catskills in the summers was the city itself was very dangerous. There was typhoid, there was cholera, there was all these things. Jewish people were not welcome at the normal resorts. There would be signs up saying no Jews. And so even if you were a rich Jewish family, a cultured Jewish family, you were not welcome there. So they started going up to... some of the farmers up there, Jewish farmers, put up little cabins, and families started going up for the summer. and the wives and the children would stay up there, and then the husbands would come up at weekends. And that was how the whole bungalow community started. They were called kokalein, which meant that you cook for yourself. So a little cabin with cooking facilities. And then, of course, the first hotels get built. And as you know, the hotels get fancier and fancier until we're in the 20s or so, and Grossinger's comes along. And, oh yeah, I have to say, one of my oldest, dearest friends in New York. We leaned on her heavily for research, didn't we? She was in the public libraries and everything. She belongs to the snootiest synagogue in New York. So she said, well, would it help? I actually know Grossinger's grandson. Like, yeah, that would help.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you think that was a problem restricted to just then, I grew up in a suburb just north of Chicago called Winnetka, and I went to Neuter High School, and our high school was divided almost evenly in thirds between Catholic, Protestant, and Jewish students and families. Some of the suburbs, like Glencoe, were very heavily populated with Jewish, right? And the country clubs around the area were restricted. The Jewish club, Green Acres is the one I'm thinking, I think it was called Green Acres, did not allow non-Jews to join. But Exmoor Country Club, where my family belonged, did not allow Jewish members. There was in Chicago a club, a luncheon club. There used to be a lot of those, and now I think there's one here in Phoenix starting up again. But anyway, the Standard Club was only for Jewish members, and there were other lunch clubs. And so that kind of exclusionary thing went on. Well, it may still be going on for
I
know.
You go into sort of the Carolinas or something.
Well, now we're finding that on a racial divide. But back then, I think we had three black students at Neuter High School, all of whose parents actually worked for some, you know, they were there because their parents were living help. And I can't remember a single Asian American. And this was a huge high school, you know, in a. And at that time, Winnetka was the wealthiest suburb in the United States.
Yeah.
So it was effectively kind of a double ghetto all the way around. Yeah. And now we're going back to that. If you've read anything about attempts to do new housing developments and so forth, that they're putting them into places. We did that in Phoenix with the Hispanic settlement over this away. There have been all kinds of
it really does.
But I didn't want anyone to think that it's just because this is historical fiction that you know this kind of thing. It is still going on with us.
Well, it's a part of Phoenix history too, because on the deed to our house, it says that our house was built in 1949, and on the original deed, it says that only white people are allowed to own that house. On the original deed. Yeah. So it's a part of Phoenix history.
Well, moving on to the fun stuff.
Moving on to fun things.
And I just think it's important to recognize that historical fiction is actually contemporary fiction as well. Just because this was people in a different time doesn't mean that people are any different today or behave really any differently. Although I think we're trying harder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, one thing we have to think about the whole time when we write these books is the characters live in 1908. All the women in this book cannot vote. All the women in this book are the property of their husband. He's allowed to beat them if he likes. He's allowed to own any property they come with becomes his. If they want a divorce, they can't take the children. So even though a lot of these women are very forward-looking, they are hampered by the restrictions of the time. And of course, luckily, Molly has two very free-thinking bohemian friends who live their own life, you know, and disobey all the rules, which is lovely, which is why we wanted to do the Catskills in the first place, because we thought, wouldn't it be fun if one of these friends called Sid, whose real name is Elena Goldfarb, we thought, wouldn't it be fun if she has to go up to her Jewish family in the Catskills, because her life is so different from theirs, there'd be a huge clash. And then I said to Claire, okay, we're going to do it in the Catskills. So she starts researching, and then the rabbit hole opens up. And what did we find next?
So one of the wonderful things we found was a community called Onteora, which means Hills of the Sky, that was started in the 1880s, that was a free thinking, a community of free thinkers, where people had their own little cabins up there and there was a communal dining hall. Mark Twain visited it, but a lot of the women that went there was heavily professional women. And some of these women were at the tops of their professions. So that's another thing, like Barbara said, that history is actually contemporary. We think there were many restrictions on women, but just like now, there are people finding ways to get through the restrictions. And so the people who went there were largely very educated women, and we wanted to bring that out. In this book, we've fictionalized it and made a community called Amicidia, which means friendship in Latin. Yeah. And that was just out of respect for the original community. Since we were going to be putting fictional people in it, it felt disrespectful to a community that actually existed. But there was so much more. So obviously we researched the bungalow communities, and this would have been the very beginnings of them, long before the Borscht Belt, but the very beginnings of what would become that. Then there was bluestone mining in the Catskills that paved the cities of New York. But very recently, Portland cement had come in as being much more economical. And so the bluestone mines were facing a crisis, an economic crisis, because their products weren't as needed anymore. Some of the last groves of chestnut trees were still alive in the Catskill Forest, but within a few years would be gone forever because of the blight that killed all of the chestnuts on the East Coast. And then Catskill State Park had just come into being in 1903, and the fire wardens had just become real park rangers with some authority to take care of the park, and a growing in the beginnings of an environmental movement and a feeling that you should take care of nature were just taking hold. So we thought, what a great place for a clash of all these different ideals there in the Catskills.
The other thing about the park ranger was he reported to the NYPD. So immediately we got a tie in to Daniel, which is good.
Back to you. I thought, I usually talk too much, so I was trying to be quiet. I was thinking, you know, Borscht Belt, just think about it. We were talking about food a little while ago, but imagine defining this whole thing partly by diet, by calling it the Borscht Belt. And if any of you are as senior as I am, I don't think anybody here is, you would recognize how many of our 20th century comedians actually learned their craft and practiced their craft in the Borscht Belt. So it was a very big cultural.
It was, and those hotels by the 30s or so, they were these giant 1,000-room hotels with the swimming pools and the ballrooms and everything else. It was just luxury.
There were lots of them like that. The one at Mackinac Island. I was just there this summer doing a cruise of the Great Lakes. Which, if none of you have ever done that, instead of flying to Europe, tour our Great Lakes. It's a 2-week cruise. It's truly amazing. And there's, the Greenbrier and other. So we had a lot of grand hotels in this country.
I stayed there. I was invited once by the owners.
At the Greenbrier. I can one-up you.
Really? Why?
Well, I got to stay in the Wallace and Duke of Windsor suite at the Greenbrier. Compliments to the hotel. I know. Yeah. It's a beautiful old hotel, and there's a brand new historical fiction book here. I'm trying to remember, something or other, the Greenbrier is the title, because it served as a bunker during World War II. It was a place of safety for many of our country's leaders as they dug in under the Greenbrier. Or maybe it was already there and they were the wine cellars. That's more likely. But anyway, I do think, are you, if you ride along, you haven't gotten to the war yet, right? Am I losing track of the time?
We're in 1909.
Where are you?
We just turned 1909.
But think how interesting it would be if by chance you're able to ride all the way up to the women's, to women's suffrage and all the rest of it.
Yeah,
there's so many things that happen.
I mean, women's suffrage, I think we're going to be dealing with in the book we're about to start, because in England at that time, exactly that time, the women were chaining themselves to the fence. One woman threw herself under the wheels, and they were being force-fed in hunger strikes. So there was a hugely a violent clash between suffragists and the police in London. So I thought I thought we might have to bring something of that into Annex.
The war clearly changed that. So many men died in the war. There were more women than men, which made it a lot easier to vote in emancipation in 1920?
Yeah, and also I think they saw that during the war, women could take over men's jobs. And, you know, women were working in the fields, women were working in the factories. And I think they had to, well, first of all, they had to allow women to cut their hair, wear shorter skirts, throw away the bustles because they needed women to work in the factories and things. And then they thought, these women actually have contributed to society. We should do something about it. So
not only that, the bicycle meant that women could wear bloomers. I remember my grandmother actually had a pair of bloomers when I was a little kid. They were taller than I was, but nonetheless. Yeah. That was a hugely freeing thing if you were able to wear bloomers and ride a bicycle astride instead of sitting side saddle on a horse with a skirt.
Yeah.
Well, so in this book up at Amasitia, the women, many of them wear pants, and there was something called the rational dress movement. And so women who subscribe to the rational dress movement might wear pants because it was, you know, easier to do certain activities, of course, if you're wearing pants. So that was back all the way in 1909, before the war.
Yeah, we have a woman, for example, who's a blacksmith in the book. You know, at the Amasitia that we've created, women do everything. They look after the horses, they take care of anything that needs repairing, and, you know, they're completely self-sufficient, so it's good.
So what we have here is a pregnant Molly in a summer where typhoid, they still haven't figured out where typhoid comes from.
Yeah.
They have not fully identified the water system as the source of typhoid. So it was popularly supposed that it floated through the air, sort of like COVID, and people could get ill. So Daniel, unsurprisingly, thinks that Molly should go and spend the summer with his mother.
Yeah.
And Molly, not surprisingly, doesn't really look forward to that.
So mother lives up in Westchester County. And so Molly goes up there, and everything's lovely and smooth, and mother-in-law wants her to rest, and she wants her to crochet some little things, which, of course, Molly is, like me, not the best crocheter in the world. It's funny how many of your own traits you put into your characters, you know. And so when she finds that Sid and Gus are up at this lovely community, and they say, why don't you come over for a few days? It's just across the Hudson. Her mother-in-law says, yes, go, darling. You know, we've got Aileen, the helper, who's looking after the four-year-old, and everything's fine. You can go. So off she goes. And little does she know that it's going to be rather eventful.
It is eventful. And I would have to say about us writing Molly that we have so much fun with Sid and Gus and Molly and Daniel and mother-in-law that we sort of think, oh, wait, somebody has to get murdered now. We were having so much fun. But yes, they immediately run into some tensions of expectations with Sid's family, and what those expectations are.
No, we'd have to kill them. No.
Yes.
And all the people watching it.
Sorry.
And those expectations cause some tension that ends up leading to a murder. And Sid's cousin is suspected of it. So, of course, Molly has to jump in. And she's very egged on by the professional women in the community because they've been told by Sid and Gus, this is a professional detective. And for the first time, she's really taken at her word because they're other professional women. And they say, all right, this is your profession. They expect her to perform it and they help her in performing that duty as a detective.
Yeah. Oh, they love to be the Baker Street irregulars, don't they? They're a little too keen, in fact. But because it is a murder, and but they're very happy to get involved. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What else can you say without spoilers?
Well, I think it's nice in the summer to escape to the Catskills. You know, I've driven through all that region and I love it. And, you know, the nice fresh smells and all of the, all of the greenery and the pine trees and everything. and Claire became an expert on the Catskill railway system, you know, because she knew exactly which station you have to change at to go from here to here. And the trains are still there, aren't they, pretty much?
Yes, there is a movement that's brought back, just for history's sake, brought back the old route up into the Catskills. And you can take a 45-minute YouTube video of the whole trip. You know, they just put a camera on the train. You can go through the whole trip. And so, yes, that was probably the hardest part of the research, was trying to know exactly what route they would have taken up the Hudson, exactly where they would have gotten off, what train they would have gone onto. For some reason, I feel like I can't write it unless I know. If there's a blank and I don't know how they got from A to B, the reader might not notice if I just said they got there, mm-hmm. but I would notice.
Yeah.
So it really was hours and hours of trying to figure out exactly the route to get up there.
That's why I gave birth to her.
You are a real exponent of the Sharon Pennington School of Historical History. Did any of you read Sharon Pennington's Marvelous Mysteries? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
She wrote medieval mysteries primarily.
Sharon Pennington.
She was a customer. Sorry, I confused them. Sorry, Sharon. Sharon K. Pennington, who sadly died, but she was a hugely respected historian. And one of the things that she always said at events like this was that to really write successful historical fiction, you can't just say they tied the horse to a tree over there. You have to say they tied the horse to a beech tree, or they. In other words, specificity is important. You can't just use general nouns, and otherwise you don't give the reader that sense of place that, you know, is so
important.
So you're sort of doing that.
Yeah,
exactly. And yes, there was research into the flora and fauna of the Catskills to make sure I didn't just write about a random mountain. You know, you can assume pine trees, but no, you have to go further into it and find
As you go through the levels, you know, you've got the things blooming, then you've got the beaches, and then you get the pines, you know. So now I think when I started this series, my aim was not to tell you about 1901. It was to take you there. It was to make you think, oh my God, I've been transported to 1901, because that's what I like to read. I like to feel I'm in a place and I'm in a time. And we're lucky with Molly because the books are first person. So everything that we see is through Molly's eyes, so we get a great feel for what does it smell like, you know, what's the temperature today. All these things are through Molly's eyes, and I think that's why we felt it was okay to visit a Jewish community, because we're outsiders. We're not saying, oh, this is what a Jewish community was like. This is how Molly sees a Jewish community. And but I did run everything past my friend in New York to say, if anything in this does not sound true to you, let me know. And she was wonderful because she picked out tiny, tiny things, nuances that we wouldn't have known. She said things like, oh, well, that level of society, they wouldn't have said Shabbat, they would have said Shabbos. You know, so things like that were really interesting to us.
Let's not forget that Molly is an immigrant. Yes. And so when we started out, we were seeing actually New York City in 1901 through an immigrant's eyes, through an Irish immigrant's eyes. You took her back one time to Ireland.
I did, yeah.
And so when she went home, she was to some degree looking at Ireland now through different eyes because now she'd been living in America.
Yeah, and it wasn't a very happy event going home. It didn't turn out very well, did it?
No.
No, that was a book called In Dublin's Fair City, and it had a lot to do with the Irish freedom movement.
It's very successful as a general rule. If you're going to send if you're going to write about a place or a culture that is not yours, doing it from an outsider perspective generally is
because
safer
you
for
notice
one thing,
things.
But you do notice things differently. Yeah.
If you're born and grow up in a place, you take so much for granted, and someone else comes in and says, oh, I didn't know that they did that on the windows of the house. And you think, what? I never even noticed, because you know, and an outsider notices everything, don't they? They notice how things smell. They note the smell of cooking. What's cooking here? Or they use a lot of garlic here, you know. And so we can use that because Molly's observing. I think one of her skills is she's a great observer.
And she's a woman of her time and of her place. Yeah. And I think that comes out. Obviously, not all of Molly's opinions are our opinions. And because of the way she grew up, she sometimes feels that Sid and Gus go a little bit too far. You know, yeah. She's happy to be a wife and a mother in some ways, and growing as the series grows in that. I think we were somewhat mean to the Italian cook she had in the last book, because if you think about someone from one culture who's maybe never encountered the food of another culture, they're not at, it's fine to go out to a restaurant, but if it comes into your house, then you might not always feel quite as adventurous about eating that food. That's and so true. When she has an Italian cook in All That Is Hidden, she feels like it's gone a little bit too far.
Yeah, well, she wasn't a very good Italian cook, no.
Wasn't a good cook.
Well, you were borrowing from Queenie when we were talking about bad cooking,
yeah,
for
absolutely.
Heaven's sake.
Yeah.
So this is 1901, when women were regularly, not regularly, but often dying in childbirth.
Yeah.
Nobody figured out that childbed fever came because people attending women in labor didn't bother to wash their hands as they went from one woman to another. So you're allowing Molly to sort of brush through one pregnancy pretty easily, and now she's pregnant again.
And she's had a couple of miscarriages,
that's
too,
true.
Which has not been good. And that's one of the things we deal with. If you have a small child, or if you're pregnant, how can you justify risking things to try and solve a murder? You know, that you can't have someone breezily saying, oh, good, there's someone dead, let's solve it. Because, you know, you've got responsibility to your child first and to the pregnancy. So each of the cases we've dealt with since she became pregnant have got a very good reason that she would have to help. And this one, too, you know, they're up in the Catskills, they're away from everywhere, and Sid's cousin has been accused of this murder. So Molly is the only one who could actually look in. It could all have been brushed under and not done at all. Molly's the only one who can be observant and to make some good conclusions.
She has some power in the situation because she is the wife of a New York City police captain. And there is prejudice going on there. In the police that have come up are quite willing to say, well, this is a Jewish matter and we think this person did it, so we'll just arrest her and it's done. Yeah. So Molly's using her power to speak up and say, wait a second, you know, you can't just take her away with no evidence. And
no, the detective's horribly anti-Semitic, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Which, you know, is historically pretty accurate.
Yeah, I mean, when you have someone saying you people, you know that you know there's a problem there.
Yeah.
Or you can read the news today at Harvard University or whatever and see it all over again.
Yeah.
So before we open it up to questions, since we're moving towards April in Paris, I thought we might talk to Reese for just a moment, if you'll forgive me, Claire, about the Paris assignment, which was her most recent book for Lady Georgie. So
that's my standalone.
Your standalone, right. Well, didn't Lady Georgie have one too?
Yeah.
Paris?
That was... Paris, Peril in Paris was
that's
2 years ago.
Right, okay. Yeah. Well, sorry.
Yeah.
There's so many books I lose
so
track.
Parises,
but
yeah.
anyway, why don't you talk to us for a moment about the Paris assignment?
This was my standalone from last year. It's another of my books that takes place mainly in World War II. And it was about a young woman who marries a Frenchman, lives in Paris very happily until the war comes, where she's sent back to England. And then a terrible tragedy happens. And she decides to volunteer and go back into France as a courier. And it goes through what all these young women, how they were trained, what they were put through in the training, and then what it was like. Because the interesting thing was, the survival rate of these young women who were dropped into France was 25%. So 75% of them knew they would not make it. And then not only that, maybe not be killed immediately, but when you face the sort of torture and interrogation and Gestapo, they had to be so brave. And yet they weren't heroines. They were ordinary girls, ordinary women who happened to speak French well for some reason. In my heroine's case, her mother was half French, so she'd spoken French to her as a child. But the risk... To live that life every day as a lie, you know, she had to wheel her bicycle past the Nazis with something in the basket to leave for somebody. And that amount of tension must have been unbearable.
I'm sure it Sure, it was. One of the things I really enjoyed about this book draws upon Risa's own life, and that at the end of the book, there are characters that end up in Australia after the war. Mm-hmm. And I think we forget, or we're so Eurocentric in terms of World War II and World War II history, we don't often think about what Australia, New Zealand, the colonies, and what it was like in the around Japan.
Yeah, well, of course, in Australia, was very much, the Australian Army were all volunteers in Europe and in Asia and everything else. And even though the war hardly touched them, in fact, there were some bombs in Darwin in the far north, but apart from that, the war didn't touch them. They thought it was their duty. And I've got something going on in this book in Australia throughout the whole story, which actually comes into like a double climax at the end, which I can't tell you about, of course.
No. But you yourself did live in Australia.
I lived in Australia, yeah. In fact, I married my husband in Australia. So, and then after that,
he's
my...
Okay, John, speak up for the Irish.
Yeah. No, I intended actually to date rugged sheep farmers. Instead, I married this man who has to have a napkin and a side plate at a picnic, you know. And wears an ascot all the time. But I moved down there, and I met and married John. My brother moved down after me, and my parents moved down after him. So my whole family was living in Australia for many years. So that was a trek I made at least once a year, all that flight down to Australia and back.
So was Australia more resilient post-war than Britain? We know it took Britain a very long time. Rationing stayed on until, I think, 1954. It was a very...
It took a long time to
recover. Part of the problem which we encountered during COVID in this country was that Britain had allowed its supply lines to become so long because of the colonies that when those supply lines were cut off, Britain was no longer able to actually feed its population or create a lot of things. If you really want a terrific insight into what it was like, I'm trying to remember, Robert Harris wrote a book. It was in part about Bletchley, but what he really did... Was it Enigma? Yeah. Thank you. Right. I need help with titles. I'm getting so old that that's the part of my memory that is...
More books.
I know. Well, you know, when you're in your 80s, your memory is just slower. There's too much stuff to retrieve up there. But anyway, I remember one of the things he talked about was how sort of gray and dirty everyone was because there wasn't enough laundry soap to wash the clothes. There wasn't really any dry cleaning fluid. Yeah. People didn't have enough soap to regularly shower. And, you know, it was awful. And I wondered how that was. And then once Rob and I were in Scotland out on the Isle of Skye, and it was in June, and they had a heat wave. I mean, you wouldn't think they would, but they actually did. It was like 100 degrees. And they have terrible black flies in the summer. So the restaurant, this sort of cottage restaurant, had previously nailed all the windows shut because of the black flies. They didn't want people, you know, to open the window. So the fragrance of the people who were cooking and serving, let alone the people eating there, was so overwhelming that the lamb didn't actually screen it. And that's when I realized what Robert Harris was actually writing about.
Being on the tube, the underground in London during a heat wave?
Yeah,
because people are strap hanging right next to you. Oh, my goodness. You really notice that. Yeah. No, I think England was because everybody tried to rebuild Germany first so that, you know, so that everything got going again there and so that
avoiding the mistakes from before.
And so my father ran a factory and he had a sister factory in Germany. He had to open up again after the war. And the Americans came in with all new machinery for that. And my father, with his factory at home, is tying up things with rubber bands still to try and make it go. So it was gloomy. It was very grim in England for a long time. And I know people who did immigrate to Australia at that time.
Or New Zealand.
Or New Zealand. Suddenly they're in a place where food is so plentiful. I mean, even when we were first in Australia, a common breakfast was steak and eggs. So you'd have an enormous steak with like two or three eggs on top of it. And of course, if you had an English stomach, you couldn't eat this amount. You'd never seen so much food in your life. So I think, you know, a lot of people immigrated to Australia in those 50s. I know people in my family did. Quite a few people in my family did.
How about questions from the audience? We probably said all we can really say it about in Sunshine or Shadow without spoiling it for you.
Yeah.
Why don't you take over and call
Anybody like to ask something?
Lisa,
self-conscious. No. Have another drink.
Yes. Yeah.
The research that Claire did you use something like newspapers.com, or how did you find 1908 newspapers?
Well, I start with the New York Times, and then I have used newspapers.com. I don't find any site that's as good as the New York Times, though, because they not only give you the facts, but then they give you the color. And so then if I read something in the paper and I need to know more about it, then I start trying to go to original sources to find out more about that one specific thing. But to give you an example for some research we're doing right now, in 1909, we're looking at what are the big events of 1909. There was something called the Hudson Fulton Celebration, where over 2 million people came into the city to watch these big parades, big naval parades, in which, to Barbara's point about World War I, the German Navy was very much in the parades and our best friends still in 1909.
Yeah.
But the New York Times, the days of this celebration, it gives you page after page of who was in every parade, what society ran it, who the head of the society was, what the float looked like. It's a researcher's absolute dream.
Yeah, and that's the big things. And then you get these tiny snippets that make a book so real. Tell them about the man with the mustache.
Yeah, this is so fun. I read about a man taken to court for alienation of affections of this man's wife. And the New York Times takes the time to point out that the poor husband was not as big or as nattily dressed as the man that has stolen the wife. And the man who has stolen the wife twirls his mustache and says that if he can't keep her, he doesn't deserve to have her. So,
yeah, you know, journalism was very colorful in those days. You know, nowadays we're taught of just the facts, ma'am. But, you know, it said nattily twirled his luxuriant mustaches or something like that. And how will you believe? Because there's so much misinformation, there's so much AI. How will you ever believe anything?
That's really true. Yeah. And if you notice, we're actually running out of electricity. There have been a number of articles about that. Our entire country, everything we do now really depends on electricity and uninterrupted flow. You know how impatient you are, you know, if like Facebook goes down or the other day Instagram went down or something, you know. And so that's going to perhaps make it even more difficult to store infinite amounts of stuff in the cloud and other things. Do you know that spies have gone back to old school? I've had these wonderful conversations, people writing spy novels. Joe Cannon, we're going to launch his book in June and so forth. Because digital stuff can so easily be hacked, spies have gone down back to, you know, like leaving a note in a newspaper on a bench. Or no, I'm really serious. Yeah. I'm not kidding. Because there isn't any way to hack that. And, you know, they're having clandestine meetings again, putting notes in trees, the whole bit. And, you know, I think that the digital world, while it's all bright and shiny and easier, we're going to find that it isn't going to be everything.
Mm-hmm. And all you have to do is write it in person.
Good point.
Very good. Really good point.
Tell my friends who have grandchildren, if you teach your grandchildren to write in cursive, it's a secret language.
Yeah. That's brilliant. Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
There's something called the Times Machine, which is the digitized New York Times. And
back to 1901?
It goes back to the early 1800s.
Wow.
And if you're a subscriber to the New York Times, you have access to it. And then I like it. It shows you the actual paper. So you're not reading sort of a web article. You're seeing the paper. But then if you want to look in more detail, you can click PDF and the words come up. So it's easy to read, but like Barbara was saying about the advertisements, you can see every advertisement in there, so you can see what dresses were going for, what suits were being advertised for,
soap. Remember Lily Langtry, you made an absolute killing in soap. But, you do need to see the images. I don't know if you know how many of you remember reading about at some point the Great Library of Alexandria, which was destroyed.
Yeah.
Do you know now that if you go to the, which I have done, to the Great Library of Alexandria, you can not only go there on their website, you can create your own shelf at the Great Library, digital shelf at the Great Library of Alexandria, and then you can populate it with digital stuff from the library. It's just unbelievably cool.
Yeah.
So, and increasingly, as medical science has developed scanning techniques and imaging techniques, they're able to actually look at old scrolls and so forth that previously nobody could unravel without destroying them. And they can now look inside and see,
telling us the other day about Herculaneum? They've got scrolls that were completely incinerated, and they've now started to be able to read them.
Right. So many things that we think are true in history that we've been brought up to believe are true, we may discover aren't. Mm-hmm. And many translations, the whole book about, I'm trying to remember, there's something in the Bible about easier than something than a rich man going, was it a camel or whatever?
Yeah. Needle?
Yeah. Yeah, and it turned out, it turns out to be something completely different.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of things are going to surprise us as we learn more about ancient documents. And
I have something funny about translations, which is that the fact that 100 years ago, someone might not know the difference between a butt dial and a booty call means that it's really hard to understand stuff that was written 2,000 years ago.
Yeah. I love it. Who can top that?
any other questions? Yes?
Will you tell us how you came up with the character for her royal spine?
Well, I was writing the Molly Murphy series and Constable Evans at that time, and my publisher said, we can't really break you out unless you do a big, dark, standalone novel. So I kept walking around thinking, okay, serial killers, child molesters, terrorists blowing up. And then I thought, I turn on television, I think, do I want to spend 6 months in this darkness? And I thought, no. And I thought, who would be the most unlikely sleuth I could ever think of? And I thought, how about if she was royal? But she was penniless. And it's those lovely 1930s with Noel Coward and Mrs. Simpson, all those delicious people. So I started writing in the first person, and I wrote about 6 pages, and those 6 pages, absolutely unchanged, became the first chapter of Her Royal Spineness. So I wrote, a few chapters, sent it to my agent, who said, I love this. We sent it to the publisher, who went, no, that wasn't what we wanted at all, no. So it was put out to bids elsewhere, and it went to another publisher, and then it started doing really well. And for a long time, the first publisher wouldn't mention it. And then they started saying, well, in that other series. And so it's been delightful, because Georgie just took off immediately. I got the feeling when the first book came out, and I went into a favorite bookstore, and I was doing something else, and I said, while I'm here, would you like me to sign some copies of Her Royal Spineness? And she said, I'm sorry. She said, Ed doesn't really bother to sign thirds. And we'd gone through 3 printings in a week, and I didn't know that. So, that was a little bit, yeah.
And this scenario repeated itself when Reese wanted to write a not Her Royal Spineness book.
I did, yeah. I got to a stage where I was itching to write about World War II, and especially I'd read about British aristocrats who had helped Hitler, and I wanted to put that into a book. So I came up with a proposal, and both my publishers turned it down. One said, it's too far from her brand, and the other one said, it's not funny. Well, no, it's World War II. It wasn't a huge laugh. So my agent said, I know who would really like this. And so she took it to Lake Union, which is one of the Amazon companies. And they absolutely loved it. And it came out, and It was a Kindle first. It came out and did 400,000 copies like that. And it's now sold another 500,000 copies. So it's very interesting how everybody now says, if Reese would like to show us anything, if she's got anything at all, she'd like to show.
And I think back to that original, if we would write a bigger, darker book.
Yeah, and
I thought, so she did write
so
a bigger, darker book,
so
and they didn't want it.
They didn't want it, no.
Publishing, you know, is a fascinating, it's really a fascinating thing. And one of the shortcomings is that it's very difficult to see beyond the next few months. Mm-hmm. It's very hard for publishers, for a whole lot of reasons I won't go into, to, you know, to see farther ahead and to anticipate the consequences.
Yeah. And, you know, whenever you buy a book, the publisher needs, I mean, obviously, it's now, it's a business to make money. So you want to know immediately, where will that book go on a shelf? And how many copies can I expect to sell? You know, and so if you can't do that, if someone says, I'm doing something completely different, the publisher says, wait a minute, I don't know, I'm not very comfortable with that. So I think...
But then things that break out of that mold do quite well. I mean, I think the book Pride and Prejudice and Zombies has sold quite a lot of... You would have said, no, you can't do that. That's impossible. But
and
I think it sold quite well.
And that's partly because bookstores are also businesses, too, other than this one, which is, you know, something I do for fun. And therefore, while my staff get paid, I do not. And so I don't actually care if we do something that's profitable, because that's not really why I'm here or why the store. We've managed for 34 and a half years on that basis, yay.
Yeah.
But lots of bookstores can't take a chance on something that they don't think, you know, will sell successfully.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of obstacles in the way of change.
Yeah, of course,
you know, is the thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, Reese has had happy endings so far for all of her decisions.
Yeah, right.
So it's really been good.
Is there one last question before we? Yes.
Yes, sir.
You're allowed, even if you're a family.
I happen to be Claire's husband and Reese's son-in-law. That she's just done, and I'm like, yeah, that sounds great. And I try not to say too much about, you know, diction or things like that, because she wants to hear the flow of the thing. But these two are really the queens of the red herring. If you're not careful, you'll be fooled into thinking one thing is happening when something else is happening. And this particular book, which I think I read a year and a half ago, you get to a point where, you know, you're trying to figure things out, and Molly's got that, and this is true, and this is this is happening. So you have ideas in your head as to who done it, and then all of a sudden in this book there is this twist that you're like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Right? And then you go, oh, S, you know. Molly is in serious danger right now. And so what I wanted to ask you was, like, who? Yeah, I'm not gonna ask you to reveal that twist.
I don't know which of us came up with that, but I love that. When I'm reading a book, I love, if I'm following along, and, you know, I'm quite well read in mysteries, so I sort of think, oh, I know now. If someone punches me in the gut, I love that. One of the examples of that was one of the early Deborah Crombie books called Dreaming of the Bones, where a character you think is going to be part of it forever is suddenly killed in the middle, and you go,
not only that, it's the first death, and it's on page 135.
And you look at it and you go, wait, that can't be true. And then you know, is she really dead? And you have to, and so I love it. If you take me out of my comfort zone, I really adore that. So
so Reese was part of an event Thursday night, which was an unfortunate night for the author, Hank Philippi Ryan, to come here, because A, it was pouring rain, and B, it was the State of the Union address. It was, you know, a tough night for her, in the sense of not a lot of people could come. But Reese came, and Jen McKinley, because they are in a group called, and Claire was here too, but Reese and Jen are part of the Jungle Red group that Hank belongs to. And in the conversation, I think it did come up where I said, one of the things that I find the most interesting in a book is that when you meet the characters, you think they are this kind of person. And when you get to the end, it turns out that in her book, no one that you met at the beginning is the person that you know at the end.
Yeah.
It's really, and yet she's perfectly honest about presenting them. And that's true about a book we have here called Simply Lies by Susan Elizabeth Phillips. It's not a mystery. But every single person that you meet at the outset of that book proves to be a different person. I don't mean, you know, a Frankenstein kind of a thing or whatever, but they turn out to be better people, at least in that book, than you could possibly imagine. And I love that kind of transformation of character, not just, you know, the twists in the story, but the fact that the people can surprise you.
And I think Hank's, all of Hank's books, this latest one's called One Wrong Word.
Which we sold out of, so this is not a sales book.
No, I think all of them, you don't know who's good and who's bad. And I think that's really interesting and fascinating, because
or they can be bad in ways you don't expect or good in ways that you don't expect.
And Hank was sharing when she was talking that when she starts writing the book, she doesn't know who's good and who's bad. Yeah. She lets
her
it happen.
The writing process is to surprise herself,
which
leads to a lot of rewriting. But anyway, she likes that.
When I write, I love to be surprised. If a character says something I didn't expect, I look and I go, oh, well, I didn't know that about you, you know.
Right. I work on the theory that if I'm surprised, by God, you all will be too.
me too.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It works that way. So, first of all, let's give Claire and Reese a round of applause.
Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.